You know, Jeffrey Toobin is the senior legal analyst at CNN and the author of such bestsellers as Too Close to Call and A Vast Conspiracy and The Run of His Life. He now has a new one that is already a bestseller. It's called The Nine. It is not about that failed ABC drama that was on last year. This is a book that takes you inside the secret world of the Supreme Court, including interviews that he did with all nine Supreme Court justices, something that I don't believe has ever been done before. Jeffrey, welcome back to KMOX.
Great to talk to you, Paul. To be fair, I did not speak to all of the justices.
Oh, you didn't?
I got to most of them, but I didn't get to all of them. But I have to add one thing. You know, when we picked the title last year, we were so worried about that ABC show.
Yeah.
Because we thought, you know, what if you started, you know, showing, you know, called a book ER or something, some book, you know, that became really popular.
Yeah, what if the show was a hit?
The person who's mentioned it, it's so forgotten.
Well, I was one of the nine people who watched The Nine.
I guess so. No, I have to say, I don't wish ill on anybody, but I was very happy when it was canceled.
Yeah, if it did well, people would think that you'd written a novelization
exactly.
of their show. So
exactly. Well, as it is, I have just suffered from no such confusion.
Now, the reason I thought that you had spoken to all of them is because you don't say specifically who you did speak to about any particular thing in this book.
Correct.
Why?
Because my arrangement with my sources, both the justices and the law clerks who spoke to me, is that I could use the information but not disclose what my source was.
All right. Now, I've got to ask you about a two-word phrase that has become part of the political lexicon in this country over the last decade or so, and that phrase is activist judges. It's usually invoked by people who don't like what a judge has done, regardless of their political persuasion. If the judge ruled against what they like, that judge is an activist judge.
Correct. And they are also, but it tends to be used against liberal judges more than conservatives. But one of the things I talk about in the book is that, in fact, conservatives have been quite activist, particularly in recent years. I mean, look at the big case last term. There you had a situation where the local communities of Louisville and Seattle had said, we want to integrate our schools, and we set up a plan where one of the factors is race. The conservatives on the Supreme Court said, I know that's what you in the democratic process decided, but we know better. We are going to veto this. We think it's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. So that's an example, I think, of conservative judicial activism.
I think that the nine members of this court certainly would all qualify as activist judges. And I would also argue you don't want people there who are going to be non-activist judges. You do want them to be making important decisions about important cases that in many cases can change the way American history is going to flow from here on forward. Don't we want that?
Absolutely. You want someone who is going to be aggressive in protecting constitutional rights. The issue, though, is whose ox is gored. You know, liberals like it when a state is told you can't ban abortion. A woman's constitutional rights protect it. Conservatives like it when a university is told you can't consider race in admissions. Both are activism, but is very different kinds.
In that regard, the 2008 presidential election would seem very important to me because while President Bush has been able to put two people on the Supreme Court because we saw both O'Connor and Rehnquist leave during his presidency, isn't it possible that we could lose three of the current justices during the next president's term?
Oh, absolutely. I think, and the three most obvious are Justice Stevens, who's 87 years old, Justice Souter, who's about 70, and Justice Ginsburg, who is in her 70s. All three are liberals. The court now is very polarized. You have four strong conservatives, four liberals, and Anthony Kennedy in the middle, usually siding with the conservatives. But if three of the four liberals leave, as I expect they will, you know, a conservative president could reshape the court in a very conservative direction for decades to come.
Does that mean that these three are purposely holding on?
I think they wouldn't say it directly, but you know, there is a tradition at the Supreme Court of justices trying to leave while the president in office is of the same party that appointed him, or philosophically in line with the justice. Because after all, they don't want to see their own decisions overturned. They want someone who will agree with them.
Now, in that regard, I find it interesting, and your book, by the way, has lots of interesting and fascinating stories in it, but one of the ones that really got to me was the departure of Sandra Day O'Connor, because it wasn't really what she wanted, was it?
Not at all. I mean, Justice O'Connor showed a tremendous amount of, had a great influence over the court. You know, in 2000, she cast the deciding vote in Bush v. Gore, making George Bush president. But she grew very alienated from President Bush in office, didn't like the John Ashcroft, didn't like the War on Terror, didn't like the Terri Schiavo case, and she didn't want to turn over her seat to George W. Bush. But her husband developed Alzheimer's disease, and she wanted to take care of him. So she left in 2005. Alas, he slipped quickly away into Alzheimer's disease, so she wound up losing both her seat on the Supreme Court and her beloved husband.
While we're talking about Justice O'Connor, what is the relationship between her and the only other woman to have served on the Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg? What was it then, and is there still a relationship now?
Oh, there very much is a relationship. You know, they're very different people. You have, you know, a tiny Jewish woman from Brooklyn, a big-boned rancher from Arizona. They couldn't be more different in their background.
Yeah.
And politically, they were not totally different, but certainly Ginsburg was pretty liberal and O'Connor was pretty conservative. But they had a real friendship, and I think Justice Ginsburg misses Justice O'Connor a great deal. I know she said, "It never occurred to me that I would ever be the only woman on this court," and she really does miss Justice O'Connor.
Talking with Jeffrey Toobin, CNN senior legal analyst, author of the new book, The Nine: Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. Is one of the secrets of the Supreme Court that most of the work is not done by the justices but by their clerks and staff?
You know, I think that's largely a myth, that the clerks do all the work. You know, in senior partners in law firms, which is about what the justices are what age they are, you know, they don't do a lot of first drafts, and neither do the justices. But in terms of the real work that matters in the court, how the justices vote, which direction they're going to send the law, that's done by the justices, not by the law clerk. So I don't worry too much about that issue.
How does the process work when a case goes before the court, and we, of course, know that there are days when they're hearing cases? Once they've sat and listened to the two sides, or sometimes three sides of a case, each getting a half hour in front of the court, then what happens?
Well, what happens is they hear arguments usually on Mondays and Wednesdays, and then on a Friday, the justices have their conference where they meet in secret, just the nine justices, no secretaries, no law clerks, no assistants, and they vote on each case. When the Chief Justice is in the majority, he assigns which justice will write the opinion. If the Chief is not in the majority, the Senior Associate Justice in the majority, usually Justice Stevens, assigns the case. So, and then over the next few weeks, they start drafting an opinion and sending it around and trying to get everyone of their colleagues to join it. And then they sometimes negotiate over wording and whatnot. But that's how the process works. It's not highly bureaucratic. It's pretty simple.
And how often is a justice's opinion changed? And I'm not just talking about after someone else writes the opinion, someone changes their vote. I'm talking about even before they go into the courtroom and listen to the lawyers. Do they pretty much know what they're going to do?
I think that's accurate. I think they pretty much know what they're going to do. A lot of the justices I've asked, you know, does oral argument change your mind? And they say, you know, maybe in 5% of the cases, oral argument will change their mind. It certainly focuses the issues for them. But neither the lawyers nor the other justices tend to have a lot of influence on the justices. They really operate very independently. They are friendly to each other, but they're not close friends. And there is not a lot of hanging out in each other's offices or influence on votes.
And in talking to them, did you hear any stories about a member of the minority getting upset with the opinions of the majority, and I mean getting really, really mad about it? Does that happen?
Rarely. Not never, but rarely. I think Bush v. Gore was an example of a case that did take a toll on the relationship among the justices. Particularly Justice Souter was devastated by Bush v. Gore. He nearly quit the court in protest. He was so upset. But they have learned to disagree without being disagreeable, and in the vast majority of cases, there are dissenting opinions, but it's not a toxic environment.
You write extensively in The Nine about that decision, the Bush-Gore 2000 decision, where for 5 weeks the country was kind of on pins and needles wondering what was going to happen. We had the Florida Supreme Court ruling one way and then the Supreme Court of the land getting involved. Take me a little bit inside what was going on in the mind of the people who were the majority in that case, the ones who ruled 5-4 to make George Bush the president of the United States. Was it all politics, or did they really feel like the politics below them had gotten it wrong?
Well, I think that question is well put. I think the justices in the majority felt that the Florida Supreme Court, which was dominated by Democrats, was really acting very politically and trying to steer the election to Gore. In turn, the Supreme Court wound up looking very political itself. Now, I can't prove that the justices in the majority were simply trying to ratify the vote that they had cast on Election Day, that it was pure politics. But the nature of the opinion is so poor and so different from the way these justices usually vote, that it does lend itself to a cynical interpretation of their motives.
You consider it a low point in court history, don't you?
I do. You know, my book is not a polemic. It's not, you know, attacking decisions. It's not thumbs up on this decision, thumbs down on that one. But Bush v. Gore is sort of an exception. I do find that it's a very disappointing decision.
And you say that Justice Souter was so angry about it, he wanted to leave his job. How close did he actually come? Did he ever have his resignation letter written?
No. I have no information that there was actually a resignation letter written. But it was a long, tough summer for him in the year after Bush v. Gore. It was because he thought his colleagues were acting politically, and Justice Souter, such an unusual man, lives a sort of 19th century lifestyle, no computer, no cell phone, likes to read in natural light, moves his chair around his chambers to catch the natural light. With that attitude comes a certain absence of cynicism, and I think he felt that the court acted very cynically, and it was tough for him.
Does he hate his job?
I don't know if he hates his job. He certainly doesn't like Washington, D.C. at all. Much prefers New Hampshire. So I think of all the justices, Souter likes the job the least. But hate is probably a little strong.
But when you talk about the ones who may leave, Stevens, 87 years old, everybody would go, okay, well, you know what? This guy has earned the point where he should go into retirement and be happy with that. How old is Souter?
Souter is just about 70. He's going to turn 70 shortly. Although, you know, I hasten to add about Justice Stevens, who's 87, his older brother, William Stevens, who's 90, is still practicing law in Florida. So this is a family with a very impressive gene pool.
Or maybe Justice Stevens just been hanging on to the job because of sibling rivalry. I'm going to last longer than my brother.
You know what? Could be.
The book is called The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court by Jeffrey Toobin. Let me give a plug to where you can buy this. You can go to KMOX.com and click on our Amazon bookstore there. If you buy it there, a portion of the proceeds will go to St. Louis Children's Hospital. Every book we have up there is set up for that deal, and the hospital would appreciate you doing it. And Jeffrey, by the way, gets a portion of the proceeds as well. And we were talking earlier, Jeffrey, about the importance of the 2008 election and the justices that the next president will probably name, and you said that there are important decisions that would be on the line there, including Roe v. Wade, which I want to talk about for a couple of minutes. And I'm curious, if Rudy Giuliani turns out to be the Republican nominee and then goes on to win the presidency, he's a pro-life Republican. What effect do you think that would have on the court?
Well, he's a pro-choice Republican.
A pro-choice, I'm sorry, I misspoke, pro-choice, right.
But he has bent over backwards to say that he will appoint justices like Samuel Alito, like John Roberts. So I think his pro-choice will be more in theory than in fact. I think he will, in fact, be a very conservative. He will appoint very conservative justices, just like President Bush did.
Now, do you think he really means that, or is he saying that to woo the conservatives to his side of the aisle before the primaries?
I think he means it. I think he has left his moderate persona behind. I don't think there is a you know, secret moderate agenda there. I think he plans on governing as a conservative and will if he wins.
All right. Now, you mentioned Justice Alito. In the book, you tell a tremendous story about how Roe v. Wade almost became like Alito versus O'Connor. Share a little bit of that with my audience, if you would, particularly the history of Samuel Alito and Roe v. Wade.
Well, it really is remarkable. You know, you can't make this stuff up. In 1992, the Supreme Court came face to face with a decision that really might have led to the end of Roe versus Wade. It was the Casey decision from Pennsylvania. And Justice O'Connor, along with Justice Souter and Kennedy, worked in secret on a decision that they felt would upheld the core of Roe versus Wade. And the core is, you know, no state can outright ban abortion. But one part of the law really outraged Justice O'Connor. One part of that Pennsylvania law was a provision that said if married women wanted to get an abortion, they had to get approval from their husbands. They had to inform their husbands, not get approval. And O'Connor thought this was paternalism, unconstitutional, and she wrote an opinion excoriating it. The only federal judge who upheld that provision was a young federal court of appeals judge named Samuel Alito. 13 years later, he succeeds O'Connor, and I think that case really illustrates the difference between them. O'Connor is a lot less conservative than her successor, and that's why the court is such a different place now.
And probably sickened her even more about her decision, the hard decision she had to make to leave the court.
It is. I mean, it made her decision harder. I mean, obviously, she didn't know who was going to replace her. And remember, there was the whole Harriet Myers fiasco. I mean, three people ultimately were named to replace Justice O'Connor. First, John Roberts. Then William Rehnquist died. So Roberts was named to replace Rehnquist. Then Harriet Myers, then Samuel Alito. So it was certainly a circuitous route to her replacement.
And ironically, by the time all of that had happened, O'Connor's husband had also died.
No, he didn't die, but he went into an assisted living facility where he can't really recognize his wife anymore. I mean, he really, Alzheimer's had basically just taken him over.
So the reason that she was leaving the court was to take care of him, and that was almost a moot point by then.
Exactly, and that's really the tragedy of the story.
This court has given Bush and conservatives some victories, but in the last year or two, there have been a few setbacks for this administration, particularly when it comes to Guantanamo, right?
That's true, because, you know, Anthony Kennedy controls the outcome of so many cases now because he's right in the middle with four votes on either side. And one issue where he definitely sides with the liberals and has so far is international human rights, insistence on the Geneva Convention being followed. That's very much a Kennedy cause, and in case after case, they have ruled against the Bush administration. There's another big case that they'll be hearing arguments in a couple weeks. We'll see if they continue to rule against the Bush administration on Guantanamo.
When you wrote the book, did you know you'd be competing for book sales with one of the justices of the Supreme Court this week, Jeffrey?
I surely didn't. I knew that Justice Thomas was working on a book, but that book had been delayed for several years, and there was some doubt that it would ever come out at all. And it's just, I think, actually a happy coincidence that we came out at the same time. I think it's probably helped both of us, though he's a lot more famous and important than I am.
I want your reaction to something he said last night. He spoke at the Atlanta Press Club promoting his book, and he condemned some of the suggestions of critics that all he does is follow Antonin Scalia's lead. He said, quote, "Obviously what it's based on is that I'm black and I'm supposed to think in a certain way. And there's no way, since I'm not supposed to think that way, that I can come up with that myself. So I must be following somebody. You make your own judgments about that line of reasoning." What do you think about that?
I think he's absolutely right. I don't think he follows Justice Scalia. What needs to be added to the equation is that Justice Thomas, is far more conservative than Justice Scalia. He is the only justice since the New Deal who thinks that much of the New Deal is unconstitutional. I mean, he is way more conservative than Justice Scalia. So I think it just reflects ignorance about the court and condescension towards Justice Thomas. It's
right.
Just not true.
Also in the news today, a Supreme Court decision that could have an impact on the death penalty nationwide. They halted an execution in Virginia until they can decide whether it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. You anticipate that decision probably to be in the spring sometime?
Yes, I do. And you know, interestingly, I think what's happening now is there is something close to a moratorium on the death penalty right now. Because lethal injection is so prevalent, and the court is considering whether lethal injection is unconstitutional, basically, with perhaps a few exceptions, they are going to stop all executions until they've resolved this issue, probably in the spring.
Cameras in the courtroom. We have them all over the place in this country. In fact, if it weren't for cameras, you and I wouldn't have a little bit of a side TV career going.
Right.
So what are these nine people opposed to? Why won't they allow cameras in their courtroom?
Well, they basically don't like the attention. They like their privacy. They like not to be recognized on airplanes. And I think it's a unfortunate situation. I don't think there's any reason why a camera shouldn't be in the courtroom, but they're the Supreme Court, and they get to make the rules.
I know they look back on things like Lance Ito, the judge in the O.J. Simpson case, and the circus that we all lived through, in which you, of course, were covering at the time, and they don't want to have to deal with anything like that. But the Supreme Court doesn't have witnesses and that sort of stuff. It's essentially just oral argument and the justices asking questions. And I think it's a great part of the democratic process that, unfortunately, unless you go and sit in the gallery, 99.9% of Americans will never be exposed to. I think that's a bad thing.
Bad thing. I agree. But, you know, as Justice Souter said once in testimony before Congress, there will be cameras in the courtroom over his dead body. And I think he has some company in that view.
Big cases coming up this session to look forward to?
I think a big case about whether states can require photo IDs to vote, whether crack versus powder cocaine sentencing amounts to racial discrimination, whether, as we discussed, the lethal injection is unconstitutional, and also a very interesting case about the Second Amendment. Is gun control unconstitutional in the District of Columbia and perhaps in the whole country?
And will
we've
we
never really looked at the Second Amendment.
And will we be hearing more about the expanding power of the executive branch?
Certainly. That's there will be a case that coming out of Guantanamo Bay, but that's a perennial in the Supreme Court, especially with the Bush administration in place.
Sounds like you've got the nine part two writing itself.
Well, nothing writes itself, I assure you, but it's always a good story.
I know you spent a couple of years working behind the scenes and talking to all of these people in there, and I think you've done a terrific job capturing the essence of what is really a secret society.
It really was a privilege to get inside the court.
Congratulations, Jeffrey. Thanks for your
Paul.
Time today. Great. Jeffrey Toobin, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. It's on sale now. If you buy it through the link on KMOX.com, a portion of the proceeds go to help out St. Louis Children's Hospital. From News Talk 1120, KMOX.